This is chapter 1, which is called Blood in God's River. In March 1866, David Livingstone, wearing his trademark peak cap, landed at Mikindani Bay on the East African coast and strode inland, followed by 35 porters and a bizarre assortment of baggage animals consisting of 4 buffaloes, 6 camels, 4 donkeys, and 6 mules. The day was fiercely hot, and Dr. Livingstone and his polyglot following of coastal Africans, Indian sepoys, and mission-educated freed slaves were soon struggling along a valley choked with rank grass that towered above their heads and made them feel as though they were being smothered. By a characteristic piece of bad luck, the doctor had chanced to step ashore at one of the few points on the coast where dense jungle stretched far into the interior. Soon the undergrowth became thicker, and his men were obliged to use their axes to hack a path wide enough for the swaying camels to negotiate. Within hours, the overloaded animals were being bitten by tsetse fly. As they weakened and slowed, the porters beat them to restore their energy. When Livingstone objected, the first mutinous voices were raised against him. His troubles were just beginning. Just over a year earlier, despite being a decade or more older than his principal rivals, the 53-year-old medical missionary turned explorer had been commissioned by the Royal Geographical Society, the world's principal sponsor of exploration, to do nothing less extraordinary than solve the planet's greatest remaining geographical mystery by finding the River Nile's headwaters. In recent years, other explorers, notably John Speke, Richard Burton, and Samuel Baker, had claimed to have reached the river's source, or at least one of its main reservoirs. But there was no consensus among geographers about whether any had proved his case. So Sir Roderick Murchison, the elderly president of the RGS, had decided, in Livingstone's self-approving phrase, to take the true scientific way of settling the matter by inviting him to ascertain the watershed. Had Sir Roderick chosen anyone else, Dr. Livingstone, who prided himself on travelling beyond every other man's line of things, would have thought it anything but the true scientific way. In fairness to him, no other explorer had spent anything approaching his 21 years in Africa, nor come close to overhauling the vast mileage he had tramped. But while he had never suffered from false modesty, Livingstone, who had started life as a child factory worker in a Scottish textile mill, and had lived in a single tenement room with his parents and 4 siblings, had not taken his selection for granted. The affluent members of the RGS were a snobbish crowd, who thought former nonconformist missionaries socially infradig, even should one of them miraculously qualify as a medical doctor. So Dr. Livingstone had been touched by Sir Roderick's loyalty. Although the two men had been friends for a decade, and Murchison had backed the doctor's epic trans-Africa journey, the first crossing of the continent by a European, Livingstone was painfully conscious that the fame and adulation he had enjoyed in the 1850s had not survived the deaths and disaster of his more recent Zambezi expedition. His objectives on that later occasion had been to prove that European traders and missionaries could navigate the Zambezi in steamships and live and work safely near the Victoria Falls, discovered by him in 1855. But despite an immense expenditure of money, time, and effort, this ill-starred expedition had merely underlined the complete impracticability of its aims. The Zambezi, far from being, as he had promised it would be, God's highway into the interior for Christianity and commerce, had turned out to be a malarial maze of shifting sandbanks leading to a chain of cataracts whose local name, Cabrabassa, meaning where the work ends, had proved to be cruelly apt. As disillusion had turned to anger, most of Livingstone's expedition colleagues had either resigned or quarrelled with him in public. Several died of malaria, as had his wife Mary, along with 5 missionaries, 2 of their wives, and 3 of their children. Even more disastrous in the eyes of the press had been the death of the first Anglican bishop ever to make South Central Africa his field of work, due entirely to Dr. Livingstone's passionate appeal to him to come out there. After his triumphant crossing of Africa, Livingstone had been lauded in the press not simply as a sublime explorer, but as a great missionary, a saintly and truly apostolic preacher of Christian truth. In the aftermath of the Zambezi expedition, saintly was the last adjective likely to be applied to him by any journalist. But if anything could help the doctor to atone for past failures, It was going to be an enterprise demanding extremes of selflessness and courage, as the Nile search undoubtedly would. The fact that he might very well die in Africa if he accepted Murchison's invitation had not tempered his eagerness to say yes. In truth, finding the source meant more to him than the restoration of his reputation, desirable though that undoubtedly was. Despite possessing many human weaknesses, and vanity was not the least, David Livingstone loved Africa and Africans and saw his geographical quest as offering an unrepeatable chance to serve the continent and its people. "Men may think I covet fame," he told a friend, "but the Nile sources are valuable only as a means of enabling me to open my mouth with power among men. It is this power which I hope to apply to remedy an enormous evil." The evil was the East African slave trade, which was then being energetically expanded by the coastal Arab Swahili and by the Portuguese colonists of Mozambique. But if Livingstone could survive and return as the discoverer of the Nile source, he believed his agenda would be adopted by politicians, with the consequence being a naval blockade of the East African coast and the closure of Zanzibar's slave market. Yet Livingstone's obsession with the Nile had other dimensions, such as historical and scriptural significance. For more than 1600 years, he told his elder daughter Agnes, "Emperors, kings, philosophers, all the great men of antiquity longed to know whence flowed the famous river, and longed in vain." But the biblical resonance of the search impressed him even more than its antiquity. An eager desire to discover any evidence of the great Moses having visited these parts bound me, spellbound me, I may say, for if I can bring to light anything to confirm the sacred oracles, I shall not grudge one whit all the labour expended. As he explained to Agnes, "If success were finally to be his, I will have shown myself a worthy servant of him who has endowed me to be an explorer. Such a confirmation of his usefulness to God would put worldly fame in the shade."